on the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Ever heard of a molecule, like a tiny one, that acts as the ultimate switch for your reproductive system? It's called gonadotropin. And get this, sometimes it's cranking up the hormones, and other times it's actually slamming on the brakes. It's kind of wild.
That's right. It has this fascinating double life. And in this deep dive, we're going to, well, unravel that story. We'll explore what it is, exactly how it pulls off this hormonal balancing act in our bodies, and some of the really successful ways it's used in medicine.
Okay.
We'll also touch on the potential flip side, you know, the side effects, and maybe why this seemingly crucial player doesn't often pop up in everyday health chats. Our goal here, based on the sources we've looked at, is to give you a clear, concise understanding of gonadotropin's role, its significance.
Absolutely. Think of this as your shortcut, yeah?
Yeah.
To understanding a real linchpin in hormonal control. Hmm. We're sort of bypassing the dense textbook stuff and just zeroing in on those aha moments, the beats that show how clever our bodies are and how sometimes maybe we can nudge them in the right direction. Okay, so let's dive in. What exactly is gonadotropin?
Okay. So at its heart, gonadotropin is a synthetic version, basically a lab-made copy, of a hormone our bodies make naturally. That hormone is called gonadotropin-releasing hormone, or GnRH for short. And what's neat about its structure is that it's a decapeptide.
Decapeptide. Okay.
Think of it like a very short string of Lego bricks. Just 10 connected pieces, 10 amino acids, but incredibly important for signaling in the body.
10 Lego bricks doing a massive job.
That's
pretty wild. So where do these natural GnRH Lego bricks get made?
They're synthesized in a specific command center in the brain, the hypothalamus.
Oh, right.
And you're right. Its main role is to act as that master switch you mentioned. Mm. It's essentially conducting the whole orchestra of the reproductive system, this kind of nuanced on-off signaling. It's just a brilliant example of how the body regulates complex systems, like a conductor, you know?
Right, like a finely tuned orchestra conductor. Okay, so how does this conductor actually get the music going?
That's where the pulsatile release comes in. It's crucial. The hypothalamus doesn't just send out a constant stream of GnRH. No, it releases it in rhythmic bursts or pulses.
Pulses, like little on-off signals.
Exactly. You could think of it like Morse code for hormones, maybe?
Mm.
These pulses then travel, it's a very short distance, to the pituitary gland. That's a small but really mighty gland right at the base of the brain.
And the pituitary gland gets the message from these pulses.
Absolutely. It picks up the signal. In response to each pulse of GnRH, the pituitary gland releases two other key hormones, luteinizing hormone, LH, and follicle stimulating hormone, FSH.
LH and FSH, got it.
Yeah, these two are like the principal musicians in our reproductive orchestra. You'll often hear them called gonadotropins together.
Gonadotropins.
Yeah.
So GnRH sends the instructions from the hypothalamus, pituitary gets it, releases LH and FSH. What's their next stop? Where do they go?
Well, LH and FSH then travel through the bloodstream down to the gonads, so that's the testes in men and the ovaries in women. And there, they act as the signals telling the gonads to produce the primary sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen. And as you know, these hormones are essential not just for fertility and sexual development, but really for a whole range of other bodily functions too.
Okay, so let me just see if I've got this chain of command right. Hypothalamus in the brain sends GnRH in pulses.
Mm-hmm.
Pituitary gets that signal, releases LH and FSH, mm-hmm. and those tell the testes and ovaries to make the sex hormones.
Mm-hmm.
And you said earlier that the synthetic version, gonadotropin, can either mimic those pulses or do the opposite, suppress things.
Exactly right. By carefully controlling how synthetic gonadotropin is administered, whether it's in those rhythmic pulses or given in a continuous, steady manner, we can either give the hormonal system a boost or, kind of surprisingly, put the brakes on. It's this dual capability that makes it such a valuable tool in the medical toolkit.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. How is this dual action molecule actually helping people? Like in the real world, we touched on diagnosis as one key area.
Yes, diagnosis is a big one. Gonadorolin is incredibly useful for figuring out if there are any communication problems, any glitches in that pathway between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. Doctors can use it to assess if these crucial control centers are, you know, working properly. So yeah, it helps us understand when things go wrong.
How does that work in practice? Like, what does a patient actually experience?
Well, the main way doctors check this is using what's called the GnRH stimulation test. It's actually a relatively simple procedure. A patient gets a single dose of gonadorolin, usually an injection, and then their blood levels of LH and FSH are measured at specific time points afterwards.
Okay.
And the pattern of how these hormones respond, do they surge up like you'd expect? Is it a weak response? Or do they hardly change at all? That pattern gives doctors crucial information.
So the body's reaction to this little nudge of synthetic GnRH tells the doctors what's really going on under the hood.
Precisely. For example, if someone has low sex hormone levels, this test can help pinpoint the source. Is the problem up in the hypothalamus, maybe not producing enough GnRH? Or is the pituitary gland the issue, maybe not responding properly to the GnRH signal it is getting?
I see.
And making that distinction, it can really change the whole treatment plan. It's key in diagnosing conditions like hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. That's basically where low sex hormones stem from issues in either of those upstream control centers.
That makes perfect sense. So, okay, beyond figuring out what's wrong, where is gonadorin proving to be a successful therapy?
Right, therapy. There are several important applications here. Let's start with infertility. Gonadorolin can be a real game changer for some individuals facing fertility challenges, specifically when those challenges are due to problems in the hypothalamus or the pituitary. And this applies to both men and women.
Okay, so how does it help women struggling with fertility?
Well, in women who have irregular ovulation because of hypothalamic issues, or maybe in conditions like polycystic ovary syndrome, PCOS, where ovulation can be very unpredictable, administering gonadorolin in those rhythmic pulses we talked about can mimic the body's natural GnRH release.
Right, mimicking the natural pattern.
Exactly. And this encourages the pituitary to release LH and FSH in a way that supports egg development in the ovaries and, crucially, triggers ovulation.
And for men facing infertility challenges, what's the mechanism there?
For men who have hypogonadism, low testosterone, caused by problems upstream in the hypothalamus or pituitary, pulsatile gonadorolin can stimulate their tests to produce more testosterone. And, critically for fertility, it can improve spermatogenesis.
Spermatogenesis, the production of sperm.
That's right, production of sperm. So it's like jump-starting the natural hormonal cascade that's maybe stalled out.
It's actually amazing. It's essentially helping the body do what it's naturally supposed to do. You also mentioned delayed puberty is another area.
Yes, and this is a particularly impactful use, I think, in children who are experiencing a significant delay in starting puberty because their bodies just aren't producing enough GnRH on their own. Pulsatile gonadorolin therapy can basically kickstart the process, and then it can help guide them through a more typical pubertal development timeline.
Wow.
It's pretty remarkable, giving the body's natural clock a nudge when it needs it.
So, again, it's mimicking the natural process. Now, you also mentioned, and this is the part that seems counterintuitive, that it can actually suppress hormone production. That sounds completely opposite to everything we've just discussed.
It does sound counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it really highlights the intricate feedback loops within our endocrine system. So while those rhythmic pulses stimulate hormone release, continuous non-pulsatile administration of gonadorolin, or actually more commonly, its analogs, has the opposite effect.
The analogs, what are those?
Think of analogs as slightly modified versions of gonadorolin. They might be longer lasting or designed specifically for this continuous action. So when you give gonadorolin or these analogs continuously, it leads to something called downregulation of the GnRH receptors on the pituitary cells.
Downregulation, meaning the pituitary cells become less sensitive to GnRH. They sort of stop listening.
Exactly. With fewer active receptors on their surface, the pituitary cells become less responsive to that constant GnRH signal. It's like they get overloaded. This results in a decrease in the production and release of LH and FSH, and consequently a significant drop in sex hormones like testosterone and estrogen. You can imagine constantly ringing a doorbell eventually. The person inside might just start ignoring it, right?
Yeah.
It's a bit like that for the pituitary receptors.
Huh. So by constantly bombarding the system, you actually cause it to quiet down hormone production.
Precisely. And this suppressive effect has vital applications in treating several conditions that are sensitive to hormones, Take prostate cancer, for instance. The growth of many prostate cancer cells is fueled by testosterone. So, by using continuous GnRH analogs to dramatically lower testosterone levels, we can effectively slow down or even halt the progression of the cancer. We starve the tumors of their fuel.
That's a powerful application. What other conditions can benefit from this kind of hormone suppression?
Endometriosis is another key one. That's a condition where tissue similar to the uterine lining grows outside the uterus, and its growth is stimulated by estrogen. Suppressing estrogen levels can significantly help with the symptoms and slow down the disease.
Okay.
Similarly, uterine fibroids, non-cancerous growths in the uterus, are also often estrogen sensitive. Lowering estrogen can help shrink them. And finally, in cases of precocious puberty where kids start puberty way too early, continuous GnRH analog therapy can halt that progression by suppressing sex hormone production, allowing for more typical development later on.
You made a point earlier about the difference between gonadotropin itself and these analogs for continuous suppression.
Yeah.
Could you just clarify why the analogs are often preferred there?
Certainly. Yeah, while continuous gonadotropin can achieve suppression, these synthetic GnRH analogs, names like triptorelin or leuprolide might be familiar, are generally favored for these longer-term suppressive treatments. Why? Well, these analogs often have greater potency, meaning they work more strongly and they last longer in the body. That makes them more effective and just more convenient for managing chronic conditions.
Right. Fewer doses needed, probably.
Exactly. Gonadotropin itself, because it has a shorter lifespan in the body, is more commonly used for those diagnostic tests we talked about, or for the very specific pulsatile therapies for infertility and delayed puberty, where you actually want that more controlled on and off effect.
Okay, that really clarifies why we might hear those analog names more often in certain contexts.
You're right.
All right, let's switch gears a bit. The other side of the coin, potential side effects. What are we looking at with gonadotropin?
Well, like any medication that significantly impacts hormones, there are potential side effects. And they're often, as you'd expect, directly related to the hormonal shifts that gonadotropin causes.
Okay, so let's break it down. What about from that single diagnostic dose? What might someone experience?
Generally, the side effects from a single diagnostic dose are usually mild and temporary, pretty short-lived. You might get localized reactions right at the injection site, some pain, maybe swelling or redness, totally normal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might experience a headache, maybe some flushing or a feeling of warmth. Nausea or mild abdominal discomfort isn't uncommon, maybe a bit of dizziness or lightheadedness. In rarer cases, someone might get a skin rash, maybe localized, or very infrequently, more widespread.
Anything serious.
It's important to mention, though rare, that more serious allergic reactions like anaphylaxis are possible, especially perhaps if someone has had the medication before. But again, rare for a single diagnostic dose.
Okay. And what about the side effects with the therapeutic uses, especially when it's used for that continuous hormone suppression we talked about?
Right. So when gonadotropin or its analogs are used therapeutically, particularly for that long-term suppression, the side effects are primarily linked to the resulting low levels of estrogen in women or low testosterone in men.
Makes sense. What does that look like?
So in women, this can mean things like hot flashes, night sweats, changes in libido, often a decrease. Mood changes, like feeling down or irritable, can happen. Vaginal dryness is common. And importantly, with long-term use, there's a potential risk of bone density loss, osteoporosis.
And for men, similar things.
Pretty similar, yes. Hot flashes, changes in libido, mood alterations are possible. Erectile dysfunction can occur. And again, prolonged low testosterone can also impact bone density over time.
So these can be quite significant effects for patients.
They can be. Mm-hmm. And it's really crucial to stress that the specific side effects, how severe they are, how likely they are to happen, it all varies quite a bit. Depends on the person, the dose, how long they're on the treatment, the condition being treated. Lots of factors. That's why close medical supervision is absolutely essential. You need monitoring to watch for these things and manage any adverse reactions that pop up.
That makes total sense. Hormones just have such widespread effects, don't they? Now, this is the deep dive, and we always like to look at the bigger picture. Why don't we often hear about gonadotropin on, say, general health podcasts or from really prominent health figures? I'm thinking of people like Andrew Huberman, maybe Joe Rogan, or Dr. Craig Conover.
That's a really insightful question. And the main reason I think that gonadotropin doesn't typically feature prominently in their content really boils down to its very specific role. It's primarily a diagnostic tool and a therapeutic agent used for particular medical conditions, mostly within specialized fields like reproductive endocrinology or treating puberty disorders. It's not really a general wellness thing.
Okay, let's take them one by one. Why might Andrew Huberman, who talks a lot about hormones, not focus specifically on gonadorolin?
Well, Dr. Huberman's work often centers on neuroscience, hormone regulation, yes, but also very much on lifestyle interventions, things people can do to optimize health and performance. While he definitely dives deep into hormones like testosterone and estrogen, his focus tends to be on mechanisms people can influence through behavior, environment, or maybe widely available supplements.
Right.
Gonadorolin, being a prescription medication for very specific clinical indications, just falls a bit outside that primary area. A deep dive on it wouldn't likely have that broad relevance for his general audience, you know?
Yeah, I see that. What about Joe Rogan? His podcast covers such an incredibly wide range of topics, and he's certainly not afraid to discuss different substances.
That's absolutely true that JRE is remarkably diverse. But when it comes to substances and interventions, the conversations often lean towards maybe recreational compounds, general wellness strategies, or things athletes might use for performance enhancement. Gonadorolin's role is just so different. It's a diagnostic tool, a targeted medical treatment. It just makes it a less likely subject for the kinds of discussions typically featured on his show. It doesn't really fit those categories.
And finally, Dr. Craig Conover. He works quite extensively with peptides, precision medicine. Seems like it might fit there.
Well, Dr. Conover does amazing work in precision medicine and peptide therapies, often focusing on optimizing health span, anti-aging, recovery, that sort of thing. And while he discusses various peptides, his emphasis tends to be on those influencing, say, tissue regeneration, metabolic health, maybe longevity directly.
Okay.
Gonadorolin's applications, infertility, delayed puberty, suppressing hormones for cancer are just much more specific medical uses. So while it is a peptide, it's less likely to be a central theme in his broader discussion, which often aim for more widely applicable health strategies.
So it sounds like the common thread is its highly specialized medical application. Mm-hmm. It puts it outside the usual scope for these figures who often focus on broader health, wellness, or performance optimization.
Exactly. It's not something you typically use or even discuss for general wellness or boosting athletic performance. It's a potent, important medication, yes, but its use is very targeted and requires careful medical management. That inherently makes it less of a mainstream topic for general health discussions.
Okay, let's wrap things up then. What are the key things, the main takeaways, we should hold on to from our deep dive into gonadorolin today?
Okay, to summarize, gonadorolin is essentially a synthetic form of the natural hormone GnRH, super important for the reproductive system. It's used in medicine in two main ways. First, to diagnose issues in that communication pathway, hypothalamus, pituitary, gonads. Second, to treat a range of conditions.
Right, the dual action.
Exactly. Administering it in pulses can stimulate hormone production, helpful for infertility, delayed puberty. But continuous administration, or using those GnRH analogs, actually suppresses hormones, which is valuable for things like prostate cancer, endometriosis, precocious puberty. And it's really important to remember that side effects are generally linked directly to those hormone changes it causes, whether boosting or suppressing.
And the absolute most important thing to keep in mind is...
The bottom line has to be this. Gonadorolin and its analogs are prescription medications. They require strict medical guidance. This isn't something to even consider using outside of a clearly established medical need, and certainly not without the close supervision of a qualified healthcare professional. Full stop.
Right. Okay. Finally, as we bring this deep dive to a close, here's a thought maybe to leave you with. Considering gonadorolin's really fundamental role, this master switch function in the reproductive system, and our growing ability now to precisely manipulate these incredibly important hormonal pathways, what are the broader implications of that power? What ethical thoughts might come up as these therapies get even more refined? Definitely something to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this fascinating exploration.